This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In the words of the Chinese saying, we are cursed to live in interesting times, a moment when the risks of global conflict, largely frozen for half a century, seem greater than in most of our lifetimes. To assess these risks, the Briefing Room is broadcasting a series of programmes examining the most likely arenas of conflict and asking what are the chances of a conflagration in each. The three we've chosen are the South China Sea, where there's renewed talk of a possible Chinese invasion of Taiwan. Then there's the European border of Russia, where Putin's Ukrainian adventure could spill over into neighbouring countries, members of NATO. But first today, the Middle East, where it's 10 months since the Hamas attack on Israel started a bloody war. Last week, Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated in Tehran. Iran has vowed revenge. Could Iran and Israel be going to war? And what might happen if they do? Step inside the Briefing Room and together we'll find out. To help me understand this dangerous time, I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, the Economist's defence editor, Professor Lina Khatib, director of the Middle East Institute at SOAS University of London, and Dr. Birger Özcelik, senior research fellow for Middle East Security in the International Security Department at the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank Joshi, if I can start with you, could you just take us through recent signs of a potential escalation?
I'd say it's real escalation, not potential. We've seen intensified firing between Israel and Hezbollah in the north of Israel over the Lebanese border, the killing of many Israeli teenagers in the Golan Heights. In response, the Israeli assassination of a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut, which is very unusual. And of course, perhaps most audacious of all, the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the political leader of Hamas, in Tehran, which is an extraordinary, bold operation. And all of this coming just a few months after we saw the biggest missile attack in history from Iran against Israel on April 13th. So I'd say we have seen escalation, and a major Iranian and Hezbollah response to these Israeli steps is now, I would say, not only likely, in my view, it is absolutely inevitable and could come any time now, including today.
Right. OK. Lina Khatib, am I right in thinking, and Shashank has obviously pointed in that direction, that the principal way in which the Gaza war might escalate into a regional conflict and beyond is if Israel and Iran are drawn further into direct confrontation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to, I think, distinguish between two things that may look similar but are not. One is whether the region becomes one theater of war, and that will happen if Israel and Iran engage in war directly, because that will also mean the different proxies that are armed by Iran in the region, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Yemen, all joining in this one big theater of war and coordinate. The other scenario is very different, which is that there can be different theaters of war that are separate and that might flare up in different or at different intensity every now and then. And what we're seeing right now is the second scenario. So sometimes things get worse in Lebanon, sometimes things intensify a bit in Syria, but we're not seeing Iran and Israel engage directly.
I think this is important, Birger Özcelik, which is that there are really no other principal actors involved outside Iran and Israel. That's the point of conflict.
That's right. The risk of drawing in other regional states, of course, is ever present. And that's what we're really talking about when we warn about the risk, the very real, potentially, yes, inevitable risk of regional an all-out conflict. We have the interests of Lebanon, of Egypt, of Jordan to consider. And there has been an intense and escalated effort to arrive at a ceasefire agreement, which we will talk about, I imagine, and negotiations to pull back Iran from the brink of an escalated war against direct confrontation against Israel.
Right, which is a very good point at which to go into what, in a sense, has held up such a thing happening before. I mean, we've covered the question on this program before, and the assumption has generally been that a big escalation would be resisted by both Israel and Iran for various reasons. So, Lina Khatib, can we take Iran first? Can you remind us why Iran, up until now, has been pretty reluctant for there to be a whole-scale escalation?
I mean, Iran has been reluctant for a very long time, and this is not going to change because it does not want to be hit directly. The way Iran operates with its proxies is it lets them be at the front line. They are the one who incur the material damage. Iran leads behind the scenes, it leads strategically, it leads sometimes ideologically, it leads through finance and training and providing weapons, etc. But it does not want to be the actor in the battlefield. And this is part of Iran's management of its regional interventions in the Middle East. All this is to prevent Iran itself from being hit. And as I said, that's not going to change.
Right. Okay. Shashank, what about Israel? What has been the inhibition for Israel against, let's say, an all-out strike against Hezbollah to its north?
The inhibition has been that, first of all, it's tied up in Gaza. There are still brigades tied up in Gaza, and that's a problem. And the second issue is that if you think about the war with Hezbollah in 2006, well, at that point, Hezbollah had about 15,000 rockets and missiles. Most of them were unguided. Most of them had a range of less than 20 kilometers. So, in other words, they couldn't even reach Haifa in the north. It fired around 120 times a day. This time round, it has, I think, somewhere over 130,000 rockets and missiles. It could fire 3,000 missiles a day for 3 weeks running. And it's almost certain Israeli missile defenses, even with American help, would be swamped. So, whilst there is a temptation to deal with the Hezbollah problem, and there will be a heavy response if Israel is struck, you can see why Israel's leadership is very cautious about this.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about how significant further escalation might happen. And Borja, you've already talked about Hezbollah. How might Hezbollah be used in the situation where an escalation is happening? I mean, would it simply be that they would ramp up their rocket attacks on Israel, and that would be the way in which it would take place?
Well, there are various different scenarios that are being discussed. These are all, we're very much in a wait and see scenario at the moment. But I mean, to add to this, there were defense chiefs very early on after the attacks of 7th October in Israel that were already at that time promoting the idea of a ground invasion into southern Lebanon across the border from Israel. I think that what we are waiting to see, of course, is how Iran will respond. And the extent to which Hezbollah will lead that offensive potentially, and that is very much in line with Iran's sort of use and deployment of its proxies. Hezbollah is the most strategically valuable, well-funded, and armed with a very strong arsenal, which is to a higher level than 2006.
Alina Khatib, that makes a lot of sense in some ways, that if you're faced with people who are going to fire a lot of rockets at you, you invade them, so you take over the places where those rockets are coming from.
I think it's not likely that Israel is going to do that. I think what Israel is doing is something, in fact, smarter, because it is showing Hezbollah that Israel is the one that has the upper hand when it comes to intelligence. We've seen hundreds, literally hundreds, of Hezbollah officers and commanders in assassinated by Israel through targeted killings, mainly in Lebanon. This shows Hezbollah that Israel knows where these people are and how to reach them. And if I'm Hezbollah, I would be maybe thinking twice about using my vast arsenal when I'm compromised when it comes to security.
Right. OK, so, Burja, that brings forward the question of whether or not Hezbollah, if asked to by Iran, or if prompted to by Iran to escalate, would actually go ahead and do it. What's your understanding?
I think the calculus is that Hezbollah will retaliate in some form or another. The extent to which Iran will allow a sort of a harsher military attack and authorize that, or to call Hezbollah to hold back, I think is what we're waiting to see. From the Israeli point of view, however, the fact that there are over 60,000 displaced from Israel's communities in the north is an unsustainable situation. There's a lot of pressure, unsurprisingly, on the Netanyahu government to resolve that issue. There have been strikes and counterstrikes across the Israel-Lebanon border for months now. And whilst an Israeli sort of ground offensive, I think, is unlikely, the pressure is mounting. And Hezbollah might decide to take sort of a preemptive strike. But again, the method of doing so has been through targeted, precision-guided missile strikes, and each side trying to reclaim that the escalation dominance and reassert deterrence capability.
Shashank, how do you see that playing out? You were decidedly pessimistic a moment ago about the dangers of escalation. So how do you see the escalation potentially happening?
My sense is, David, that the rules of the game, which are fairly established in, for example, only striking disputed territory on each side, that those rules have come under enormous stress in the last several months. And I mentioned that April was the biggest missile strike in history. It was the first time Iran has ever used ballistic missiles overtly on its own name against Israel. We saw in Israeli response a missile strike against Iran. I think that was the first Israeli ballistic missile strike against Iranian soil rather than a secret operation. So these rules are being stretched. And my concern is that Iran sees this Tehran assassination of Haniyeh such a provocation, it could repeat something like April 13th, that it could cause some casualties, and that neither side, or actually both sides, perhaps overestimate their ability to keep this escalation completely in check.
So, sorry, remind us what April 13th was.
April 13th was, of course, this huge Iranian missile barrage against Israel, which was in return for an Israeli assassination of a senior Revolutionary Guards commander in one of Iran's diplomatic facilities in Damascus. So it was another one of these tit-for-tat right. cycles that became very, very sizable in magnitude.
But you're talking there about a large part of the escalation being absolutely directly between Israel and Iran, essentially kind of exchanges of missiles or whatever between the two countries. What about the significant escalation via Hezbollah? And do you think that one is likely to happen? Because you've all depicted the very heavy cost to both sides if it were to.
I think that Hezbollah, as we just heard, is likely to retaliate. I think it will keep its retaliation in check. I would be very surprised if, for instance, we saw the use of its longest range missiles or we saw serious attacks on population centres. I still think they will focus on military targets, which is a very deliberate decision. And I think the thing you have to remember here, the big picture is for Iran, but also for Hezbollah, you know, the group's role for Iran is as a insurance policy in extremis, in part. If there's a big attack on Iran's nuclear program, for example, it would want Hezbollah to be able to intercede on its behalf and ease the pressure. There's no point risking the destruction of Hezbollah now over this issue when it may be needed a year down the line. So really, there is an element of restraint here, even as the escalation occurs.
Okay. Burja, let's talk about other countries potentially getting drawn in or other places. I mean, we saw already the question of the Houthis in the Gulf, and we've talked about Iranian proxies in other countries such as Syria. What are the dangers outside just Lebanon and Iran, Israel?
I think there are a number of ways in which this could expand and sort of spill over. And we've already seen strong indications of that happening. I think the wider question of will the conflict between Israel and Hamas and Gaza, will it become a regional conflict, has already been answered in many ways because of the activities of the proxy groups and the counterstrikes. There was an attack recently in recent days against U.S. Military airbase, of course, in Western Iraq. And this is consistent with the activities of Iran-backed proxy groups in Iraq and Syria, targeting U.S. military interests, assets, and personnel. So this is a very clear method in which the U.S. has already been dragged into the conflict. It's targeting by proxy groups in Iraq as well as in Syria. The Houthis in Yemen, as you've mentioned, have been actively working to disrupt maritime trade, affecting negatively supply chain continuity globally through the Red Sea. And very soon after the assassination of Haniyeh, there was declarations of support, very strongly so, from across the so-called axis of resistance, which has led many to believe that any type of Iran-led retaliation will be a multi-front one. And so the risk of escalation in terms of Iraq, Syria, Yemen is very much a clear and present danger. Just if I could go back to the point about one of the other inhibitions on Hezbollah and its options for carrying out sort of a strong military retaliation against Israel. I think the level of domestic politics in Lebanon and the role of Hezbollah within Lebanon itself, given the political, the economic challenges that the country faces. I mean, Hezbollah has been cautious in its approach. It understands that there is zero appetite in Lebanon for an all-out war with Israel. And I think to an extent they are sensitive and must be sensitive to that sentiment.
Lina, I was going to ask you that exact question, which is we talk about Hezbollah often and Israel as if there wasn't a Lebanese government in Lebanon which had its own interests and maybe could act in its own interests itself. What is the position there?
Oh, the Lebanese government is an observer in this scenario. The Lebanese government certainly does not want Lebanon to be dragged into war with Israel. It knows there is no popular appetite for this. It would not serve Lebanon in any way. It would add to the financial catastrophe that's already there in Lebanon. And therefore, we've seen statements by the Lebanese foreign minister, for example, to the international community, calling for stepped-up diplomacy, but also clearly showing that the Lebanese state has no sway whatsoever over Hezbollah. It shows that decisions to enter war are taken by Hezbollah and Iran and not in coordination or through approval by the Lebanese government.
Shashank, one of the things that's come up in this discussion is the possibility of attacks on American assets by essentially Iranian proxies as a way of somehow levering some kind of influence in the situation. Can you tell me how that calculation could possibly work?
Yes, in fact, but it's not a potential. We've actually seen several American personnel injured in a rocket attack in Iraq, I think just days ago, just a couple of days ago. So that's occurring. And that's by Iranian allied militia in Iraq. And I think the theory is that if you can put pressure on the Americans and show them that their bases in the region, in Syria, for instance, where there are special forces in Iraq, not yet in the Gulf states, but there are, of course, bases there as well, then you can intimidate them into saying, don't get involved. Because if you get involved, then you are at serious risk of having these attacks intensify, having more people die and getting sucked into this war months before an election in which you, the White House, really don't want to get involved. So I think it's a sort of deterrent message being sent by what Iran calls the axis of resistance, its network of armed militia groups in the region.
Lina Khatib, Shashank anticipated my next question in a way, which was there is indeed a big election in November. How much do you think who's in charge of the White House become a factor in what might happen in the case of serious escalation and also in the calculation of the principal actors about whether there should be such an escalation?
In general, the US has been taking a backseat when it comes to the Middle East. And that's because the US has had other interests, such as China, Russia. And this kind of approach to the Middle East has been relatively continuous across different administrations. It began under Obama. It actually continued under the Trump administration, despite his adopting what he called a maximum pressure strategy towards Iran. And the Biden administration has more or less carried on. So if the Democrats remain in power, I don't expect to see a significant change in U.S. policy. If Trump is back in power, the difference this time is that, for example, the FBI has talked about a plot that Iran had been planning to assassinate Trump in retaliation for the killing of General Qasem Soleimani during the Trump administration in 2020. If I am Trump and I am in power, chances are I will not want this to kind of slide. Most likely, I think there's going to be change when it comes to U.S. policy towards Iran. But that does not mean that the U.S. will want to enter any direct confrontation with Iran. There are other ways in which the U.S. can seek to undermine Iran's regional influence in the Middle East. And I frankly certainly hope no matter who's in charge will begin to actually activate such a plan.
Shashank, do you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's broadly right. I think the exception is if we see such heavy attacks on Israel that their defences are overwhelmed, there could be a pressure on America to say we must go after the Hezbollah launch sites, hit the coastal batteries if they're risking US naval vessels offshore. I think that is unlikely. But the point here, David, is that escalation can have a dynamic of its own once it begins, pushing actors to do things they didn't want to do at the outset.
Right. One of the big worries has always been the possibility of an escalation to a kind of any form of nuclear exchange. And there's a recent US intelligence report I saw that stated that, and I'm quoting from it, there's been a notable increase this year, 2024, in Iranian public statements about nuclear weapons, suggesting the topic is becoming less taboo. Is that something we should be concerned about, Shashank?
Very much so. It's by a number of senior people who say that the existing fatwa or religious prohibition on nuclear weapons set by the Iranian leadership could be reversed if Iran comes under continuing military pressure from Israel. But the real reason for concern is that it's occurring alongside an astonishing growth in both the stockpile of Iran's enriched uranium, including a portion of which is enriched to 60%, which is very, very close to weapons grade, and an expansion of the centrifuges that effectively enrich that uranium, including the installation of more advanced centrifuges, all of which means that if Iran decided today to push for to build fissile material for one bomb, it could do so in less than a week. It would take longer to weaponize it. But the point is, Iran's rhetoric is changing as well as its actual tangible nuclear capabilities under that as well.
I'm sorry to do this to you, but could you put any kind of timescale on how long it would take them to actually have a nuclear weapon?
Well, if you talk about a deliverable weapon with a, you know, on a missile miniaturized in a warhead, I think you're looking at more than a year. But in some ways, the problem is once you break out, acquire the fissile material, if you can hide it, conceal it, the problem is you may not be able to find it. So the year's timeline may be overly sanguine. I think the concern is how quickly they could actually produce the material and or even indeed do so in secret.
And I would imagine, Borja, that Israel would want to try and interdict that situation long before it actually came to fruition.
Yes, undoubtedly. And that has been a longstanding strategic objective of Israel from a defense and security point of view. I think a major inhibition on the Iranian side for not escalating in a very harsh manner, but to retaliate without triggering all-out war, is that assessments are that Iran is nearing the ability to cross that the nuclear threshold. And the wider strategic objective there is to be able to safeguard, to protect to shield as much as possible Iranian nuclear facilities from a possible Iranian sort of targeted strategic strike inside Iran.
Yeah, Israeli strike, yeah.
That's right.
Lena, can you remind us about Israel's nuclear capacity? Because I think the formal position is they don't agree to say that they have got nuclear weapons, and everybody knows they do.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the message sent by Israel, which is to say nothing, really.
Right. Okay, so yes, they have, and they don't say anything. Borja, apart from the diplomatic nightmare of a serious escalation, what are the other global implications? We've talked about the Houthis and the shipping and so on. What else could happen?
I think there are a number of sort of unfortunate global dangers from the war in Gaza and potential escalation. One, of course, as we've mentioned, are the knock-on effects on the global economy. So oil and food price spikes, potentially disruptions to supply chain. Another is the growing sort of reality of political polarization, of course, within the Middle East itself, but also abroad. We've seen this over the past month since the 7th of October attacks in the US on university campuses, street protests in London and elsewhere in Europe. So this growing sense of political polarization and opposition to government policies that are seen as being too closely aligned with Israel's military activities and approach in Gaza, for example. The bigger, however, the sort of the strategic challenge is how this will contribute to the progress, the momentum around this rival competitive order led by the likes of Russia, China, Iran, the BRICS community, effectively against the sort of the Western order, as we describe it, the international rule-based order. So we're seeing that kind of competition and cooperation where we wouldn't have seen before coming about over the war in Gaza, and the potential for that to escalate in the absence of a ceasefire agreement, and also if this war is to spiral into sort of the unknown uncharted territory. There are others. I mean, another sort of global thread is the rise of the normalization of asymmetrical warfare methods, the growing role of non-state armed actors, of course. Islamic State is reported to be reconstituting in parts of Syria. So what kind of threat will that cause? And wider consolidation of resistance groups and what that might mean for security and defense in Europe and the US and sort of elsewhere.
Shashank Joshi, we have 20 seconds. We have a pretty big investment here in Britain in trying to make sure none of this happens, don't we?
Absolutely. We're going to have to evacuate large numbers of people. We have military bases and presence in the region. I think what people sort of need to really remember is that this is not like the old conflict. The rules are changing. October 7th has changed a great deal.
Thank you. Sorry to be so scary to all listeners. My thanks to Shashank Joshi, Lena Khatib and Borja Özçelik. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Drew Hindman. The editor was Richard Varden and the sound engineer was Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
In 1962, President John F. Kennedy articulated his vision for why we, or rather America, would choose to go to the moon.
We choose to go to the moon. In
the Kennedy archive, you hear Cold War competition front and center.
You'll be sure we are behind.
But this rubs up against the ethical dimension of space endeavor, which says that when we take these giant steps, they should always be for the benefit of all humankind.
We shall make up and move ahead.
Who gets to go? And how it impacts the rest of us and space itself are vital questions to answer in a looming new era of space travel. So come with me, Matthew Side, to explore the moral dilemmas that sit at the heart of space exploration and why they should matter to you. Sideways, a new frontier. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.